Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace.
And Jay Bradshaw.
And this is a Friday Spotlight episode. And today we're going to be talking about a few books. They'll happen to be DC books this time, which, you know, on Friday Spotlights, that tends to sort of be the case, although sometimes we have independents. Obviously, we have Marvel Mondays to go in depth on Marvel books. So anyway, we're going to be talking about Hawkman number 10. We're going to be talking about The Batman Who Laughs, Grim Knight, number one. And we're going to be talking about Wonder Twins, number two. So that's actually where we're going to start, Wonder Twins, number two. This was a 12-issue miniseries written by Mark Russell. The art is by Stephen Byrne. It's from the Wonder Twin, or the Wonder Comics, rather, imprint that Brian Michael Bendis sort of started at DC, and I honestly had more expectations that this was going to be better. Big fan of Stephen Byrne, and I guess just based on sort of the style of what Mark Russell was going for, I feel like his work here is a little more sort of cartoony, which is okay in and of itself, but it's also a little more simplistic, which, you know, I get that Mark Russell's writing tends to be humorous and sort of satirical, and he's poking fun at different things. You know, on one level, you can, you know, kids can read this and they can enjoy it and it can be kind of funny. But on a deeper level, adults read it and they get more out of it. There's like sort of political commentary, and that's all fine. But I think the less sophisticated art makes it seem more like it's kind of dumbed down. So I don't know. Just it didn't work for me as well as other things Mark Russell has done, like his Flintstone series, his Prez series. I think the Snagglepuss series worked really well. This worked for me on that kind of level. But then again, a lot of the Wonder Comics, I feel like, were sort of underachievers. I just remember being so excited for this when I heard about it at New York Comic Con when they announced it. You know, Stephen Byrne was there and I thought, oh man, it's going to be great. And I even went up to him after the panel and told him how excited I was. And then ultimately, you know, it was 12 issues and it was okay. It was entertaining, but it wasn't, I don't know, just didn't live up. Maybe my expectations were too high being a, you know, fan of the Wonder Twins. That Super Friends cartoon is sort of, you know, I remember watching it when I was very, very little. And it's sort of like how I first was introduced to the DC heroes, right? Superman and Batman and Aquaman and Wonder Woman, Robin, and others that didn't even necessarily show up in the DC universe. Obviously, the Wonder Twins and their monkey Gleek weren't originally in the comics. Black Falcon, Apache Chief was another one. And then there was the Asian guy whose lower body turned into a tornado. I think he was just called Samurai. I'm trying to remember. And once in a while, I was always glad when Green Lantern would show up, which was very rare. And I don't know why they did Black Vulcan. Yeah, Samurai is what he called. Japanese hero in Super Friends animated series. But I never understood once I became a DC fan, you know, more of the comics and learned more, like, why did they put Black Vulcan in there, who was basically Black Lightning, had the same powers, still a black guy? Like, why not just call him Black Lightning? I don't know. Maybe they thought kids were going to run outside and try to get struck by lightning. I never really understood that. So anyway, to get back to the book here, Wonder Twins number two, in the first issue, we meet Zan and Jaina. Sure, obviously the Wonder Twins, they have the same powers they do in the cartoon. They're each shapeshifters. They bang their fists together. They say Wonder Twin powers activate. And Zan, the boy, can turn into anything that's made out of water or any of its forms. So he can turn, you know, liquid water. He can turn into steam. He can turn into ice, various shapes of those kind of things. And Jaina can turn into any sort of animal. So a lot of alien animals over the years we've seen her turn into, and their most frequent forms, I guess you'd say, is Janna will turn into a bird and Zan will turn into a bucket of water. And, you know, and Janna's like an eagle, right? And she swoops up the bucket, and that's how they travel. Like, she takes them where they need to go. So it's kind of interesting when you think about it, because, you know, they're obviously aliens and they can form these different things. They're changelings for sure. But they're, you normally, at least when you start talking about, you know, rearranging molecules or whatever, you're not going to gain or lose any mass. But sometimes she'll turn into, you know, like a mouse. And she's not like a giant human-sized mouse. She's a little tiny. So where does the extra mass go? And other times, you know, she's turned into a giant dragon or what have you. So again, you have to wonder, where does that extra mass come from? And then the same thing for Zan. But it kids cartoon, so I guess you don't think about it too much. Anyway, this issue starts off. There's this supervillain called the Scrambler. And apparently he has the ability to switch, like, brains with people. Like, he stares into somebody's eyes and it's like a Freaky Friday thing. So how did he ever get captured in the first place, and why is he stuck in his cell as long as he is? Because once he decides he's going to escape, he basically just gets a guard to come close enough, they swap, you know, he does his little scramble thing, and then he takes, you know, and the guard's like, you know, all freaked out, and so he's now got the keys. He opens the cell door, he walks into the cell and goes, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do that. And the guard walks out in Scrambler's body, and then Scrambler switches back. So now the guard is in his own body, but he's locked in the cell, and Scrambler just walks out. Piece of cake, right? And so you wonder why he let him, how could he get, it's a pretty powerful power to have. He let himself get caught in the first place. What we don't see is how he actually gets out of the prison, but assuming it's not too much harder for him, but he comes walking out in his little orange costume, which he's got a fried egg as his sort of icon in the middle of his shirt, which I get it. Like, you're the Scrambler, like scrambled eggs kind of thing. But the icon on your shirt, the picture is a fried egg or a sunny side up egg. It's not even like, it doesn't make any sense. Like, if you're going to use an egg to say like scrambled eggs, then wouldn't you have a plate of scrambled eggs? Cause you're the Scrambler. Yeah, I guess don't think about it too much, right?
Yeah, don't think about it.
I just noticed. I'm like, wait, so he's the Scrambler. Like, what is that on his chest? Oh, it's an egg. Okay, he's a Scrambler. Egg scrambles. Okay, I got it. But wait, why is the egg not scrambled? So yeah, I thought it was kind of weird. Anyway, we see Zan and Janna. They're in high school. And we don't find out what exactly happens, at least not in the first couple issues. We do, in the first issue, we saw Superman talking to their dad. And their dad was intimating that something terrible had happened to them on their planet of Exor. So Superman brings them to Earth, and they're trying to acclimate, and they're basically interns. They're working at the Hall of Justice and they're going to school. So they're supposed to go on this trip to the planetarium, but because of budget cuts. So again, this is where these little jabs at modern society come in from Mark Russell. Instead, they're going to have to go to a field trip to somewhere else where they can get in for free. So where do they go? Well, they go to that same prison that we just saw the Scrambler escape from, Lexicon Prison and Call Center, it's called. So they go inside and they see all the prisoners are chained to their stools, and they're working these calls, and, you know, they're getting a tour by, you know, person that runs the prison. And she mentioned something about how, because Janna calls her out. She's like, how exactly is them working phones rehabilitate them? She says, customer service skills. They'll make them valuable employees on the outside. And she goes on to say that 9 out of 10 of these inmates who receive this training don't reoffend. And Janna's like, so basically what you're saying is 90% of these people shouldn't be here in the first place. Because on Exor, they don't even have prisons. And this woman who runs a prison, she doesn't exactly like that. She's being called out by a kid. So in the next panel, we see Zan and Janna reboarding the bus, and Zan saying, you're the only person I know who can get kicked out of prison, Janna. So then on the next page, we get a scene with a couple of villains that are trying to behead Beast Boy from the Teen Titans. And he saves the day by throwing them hot mess fruity pies and keeps them from chopping off his head. And this is kind of a callback to the old DC comic, well, Marvel comics too, especially in the late 70s, early 80s, where they used to have these hostess pies or hostess Twinkie ads in the comics, where it was like an actual comic story, like a one-page comic story of some like Spider-Man or Superman or Batman or whoever who was about to be defeated by these villains, and they would throw pies at them, and the villains would come distracted by eating the pies, and they would, the heroes would capture them. So it's a little nod to comic history here. And once Beast Boy gets finished filming his little commercial, Superman's there, and basically Superman's there to say, hey, we have these two new interns from the Hall of Justice, Zan and Jaina, and you know, since you're a young hero, we want you to show them the ropes. So meanwhile, the Scrambler is contacting Lex Luthor, and apparently he was at one point in the Legion of Doom or about to be in the Legion of Doom. And so he calls Lex now he's out of prison and wants to know, hey, when's the next Legion of Doom meeting? And Lex is like, oh, we already filled your position. And Scrambler's like, what the heck? I was supposed to be on that team for at least a year. Lex is like, yeah, but you were in prison. He's like, yeah, but I broke out. Lex says, yes, and you have me to thank for that. You know, it's such a minimum security lexicon prison and call center. So he goes, look, why don't you head out to the farm team, sort of a farm team, he calls it, for the Legion of Doom, and dazzle us. And so he heads over to a meeting of the League of Annoyance instead of the League of Legion of Doom. Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice, Beast Boy's kind of showing Zan and Jaina around. They're kind of comparing notes on mistakes they've made when they were shape changing accidentally here or there. And there's a little talk about prisons. Jaina's like, I don't understand why you have so many prisons. Does that, you know, make sense to you that you capture these villains and you put them in prison and then they break out and you capture again, like this never ending cycle? And Beast Boy says, yeah, we just go after him again. She's like, does this make any sense to you? She's like, what? You don't send people to prison on Exor? And Zan and Jaina are like, we don't even have prisons on Exor. Closest thing we have is community college. Beast Boy's, this works great. You'll see how it works. So first assignment, they're actually going to take down the League of Annoyance. So the scene shifts and we're actually seeing them have a meeting, the League of Annoyance. And I think it's in the, yeah, it's in the back of a toy store where they meet up. And so Praying Mantis is the leader. And we're introduced to the Scrambler, obviously, who we already met. There's Aunt Fetamine, who apparently her superpower is to be able to stay up all night, I guess. There's Druncula, who is a vampire, but who tends to bite people who are inebriated, and he ends up getting drunk himself. But he's been sober now for a month. He's not drinking anymore. He wants to change his name to Baron Nightblood. And his new idea is to troll the Justice League on social media. That's his big master plan. And Praying Mantis is like, I hoped your latest plan would have a little more of biting people involved. It's like, why does it always have to be about biting? Well, because you're a vampire. Look, man, I'm 30 days sober. You know what my triggers are. I bite a couple people before I know it. You know, I bite somebody who just had some white wine, bite some people who had cocktails. And next thing I know, I'm passed out in the liquor store parking lot surrounded by corpses, trying to leave that life behind. It's like, man, you know, being a vampire is sort of the whole reason you're here. He's like, fine, I'll go bite some people. Real creative. And you can see the Scrambler's just like embarrassed to be with these people right now. So meanwhile, back at the Hall of Justice, Zan and Jaina are talking about how useless the whole prison system seems, as Jan is looking, or Zan rather, is looking through a magazine and comes across a failed circus monkey, America's number one pet. Intelligent, highly trained, flea dipped, and overnight delivery. So I guess we're getting our version of Gleek. And then the Justice League supercomputer goes off and says, oh, there's a Druncula sighting. And so they're like, okay, great. Let's go track him down. And Druncula is outside of a steakhouse where supposedly they don't even serve alcohol. So he's going to try to bite some people, as he told Praying Mantis he would. And the Wonder Twins show up, they capture him. And what do? Of course, they take him to jail. But the jail's really full. And they take him to that same lexicon holding center. And they say, well, we don't really have any room for them, but we'll find some place. And they give them a little buzzer. It's basically like, you know, when you go to a restaurant and they give you the little buzzer, when you put your name on the list and they're like, well, you know, it'll buzz when, you know, your table's ready. That's what this guy tells them. Like, it's Zan and Jaina's job to take him to court, but that's what this guy tells him, right? Like, okay, this is going to buzz when you need to come pick him up for his arraignment. And so, they stick him somewhere not in the normal, like, population because it's full. So meanwhile, the next day, Zan's monkey has arrived, and he is indeed blue, just like Gleek. And then right there, their buzzer goes off, and they head over to get Count Druncula or Baron Nightblood or whatever he wants to call himself. And the guard's like, yeah, we're pretty busy last night, so we just had to keep him in the drunk tank. And Janna's like, wait, you put him where? And so, yeah, sure enough, when they open the drunk tank, all the people that are in there are dead. And he's kind of there on his knees saying, I never wanted any of this. I was 30 days sober. And the Wonder Twins are looking on in horror saying, what have we done? And we get the little blurb for next issue, Gleek. So, yeah, it is humorous. And it is Mark Russell, so you do get a little bit of social commentary. But here's the thing. Unlike Flintstones or like Snagglepuss, it's not, or Prez, which was very satirical and very much like a sort of a commentary on today's society. This isn't that. It's sort of like Mark Russell light, because I think they're trying to keep it kid friendly. And so it doesn't do either thing very well, right? It's not a great like kids comic introducing Zan and Jaina. I mean, it's okay for kids, but it's not like super funny or super cool action, or, you know, we barely get to see them use their powers in this issue when they're fighting Druncula. So yeah. And a lot of the humor is going to go over the kids' heads, but then it's also not such an examination of society or so satirical for Mark Russell that it really ticks that box either. It's trying to be both, and it ends up being neat, doesn't do either thing particularly well. And I think that's kind of the problem with the whole series. And even though it's Stephen Byrne, like I said, and his work on Green Arrow, I think is exceptional. This is a little toned down. This is a little more all ages type art. It's still clean art. It's still good art. I mean, the storytelling is still great. The panel layouts are pretty simplistic, but again, if you're trying to appeal to a younger audience, you don't want to get too crazy with experimenting with panel layouts and such, but the storytelling is solid. You know, line weights are really thick, which again, you kind of expect, and gives it more of that kid comic feel. So overall, it's okay. But not great. I think it could have been done better. And I should also mention the letters are by Dave Sharp. Otherwise, Stephen Byrne handles all the rest. You know, he does the line work and the colors. So what did you think of this, Jay? I know you read the whole Maxi series as well.
Oh, yeah. When you do that, though, you got to go, meanwhile, back at the Hall of Justice, because you like the TV show. No, when it came, out, I didn't expect to be like the Flintstones at all, because I kind of figured, well, it's, you know, the Wonder Twins. I mean, they weren't like the best characters in the Super Friends either. Because I remember watching that as a kid. It was Super Friends, then that went away, then it was Super Friends Hour, and that's where they showed up.
Yeah, but when I say Flintstones, I'm talking about the Flintstones comic series that,
yeah, I read that, yeah,
Russell did. Yeah, that one, just, I mean, I guess I see what you're saying, like that's a totally different tone in the cartoon and in the comic, but I don't know, I guess just because Mark Russell did the Flintstones and it was so good that I was kind of expecting this to be really good too, and it was just okay.
Yeah, I kind of expected it to kind of be this way, but I enjoyed it. I mean, I got all the jokes inside of it. You know, like you said with the pies, I was like, yeah, they do that now with I think Snickers. You buy the new comics, they got the Snickers in it now. Yeah. So it was like, okay, that's funny. They're making fun of the prison system, which is true. It's like, okay, that's funny. They're just making jazz left and right. So I appreciate it. It was funny. I liked the series, but I think when it first came out, I don't think it was supposed to be limited. I thought it was just supposed to be ongoing, but I think maybe because the sales weren't that great, they changed it.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think maybe it always, unless it was really going to take off. I mean, none of the Wonder comic stuff is even still going. A lot of it didn't even last. A lot of it only went 6 issues. So they did get 12 out of this, which, so yeah. I mean, I mean, Young Justice is done. Dial H only went 6 issues. The most successful of the Wonder comics was the Naomi, and that was supposed to get a second volume, still hasn't.
Right.
That only went 6. Amethyst was supposed to be unlimited and was trying to think what else. I mean, Young Justice was probably their biggest property, and even that didn't last that long because, again, it just wasn't very good. I mean, this was like DC Dan Didio basically giving the keys to the car to Bendis and giving Bendis a chance to work with a bunch of his friends, which is great if the books are good. But I think overall, with the exception of Naomi, the books were subpar, and Young Justice that Bendis did was terrible. It was, there was no plot to that book at all. It was just,
yeah, I kept hoping it'd get better, but it never did.
No, it was awful. So,
yeah, but I like the villains too, because, you know, they're not real superheroes. Because I mean, water, I mean, what are you gonna do with water? I mean,
yeah,
this, I mean, I think every superhero has a villain that has some kind of like freezing power or flame. So I guess if you need them, I guess you can call on them. So if they had like a B team, was pretty funny, because like, okay, they really can't like really superheroes, you know, fighting.
Yeah, the villains in this throughout the whole series are the best part about it. All right, well, let's move on to something a little better. The Batman Who Laughs, The Grim Knight, #1. So this is basically, I kind of think of it as, what if you mix the Batman and the Punisher? You end up with the Grim Knight. So it's written by Scott Snyder and James Tynan. The art is by Eduardo Risso. Colors are by Dave Stewart, and letters are by Sal Cipriani. And when I say Batman mixed with the Punisher, I'm not like pulling that out of thin air or saying that's the vibe I got when I read it, although it kind of is. But that's directly from Scott Snyder when, just like I was just talking about Wonder Twins being announced at New York Comic Con, this title, this one shot, was announced at San Diego Comic Con by Scott Snyder on, I think it was a Dark Knight Metal panel, or it might have been a Batman panel, but anyway, he was talking about the Batman Who Laughs series, how he didn't feel like he got a chance to spotlight him as much in the Metal series as he wanted to. So that's why he gave him the limited series. And then he said, yeah. And then spinning out of that, you know, you're going to see a Batman who loves guns. And he talked in depth about what he saw as the Grim Knight. You know, he talks about how the origin of him, where, you know, his parents are still killed, and instead of recoiling from that or, you know, making that vow and never wanting to use guns because of his parents being killed by guns, instead, when Joe Chill drops the gun and Joe Chill's looking around the ground for the pearls, Bruce Wayne, as a child, picks up the gun and wants his vengeance right there, and gets it by shooting Joe Chill, and then starts his love affair with weapons. And he talks about how he basically turns all of Gotham City into a weapon. And so it's a little different, right? Like you don't think of the Grim Knight, because most of the villains that we saw in Metal and then in Death Metal, they were Batman somebody, right? Like you have your Batman Green Lantern hybrid, you have your Batman Flash hybrid, you have your Batman Doomsday hybrid, your Batman Wonder Woman hybrid, and so on and so forth. And those were sort of the Dark Knights, as it were. And then in Metal, it gets expanded, right? When Snyder and Capullo decide they're going to go, no pun intended, batshit crazy, and say, okay, here's Batman mixed with a castle. Here's Batman mixed with a T-Rex. Here's Batman mixed with a Batmobile. And obviously the apex of all these being Batman mixed with the Joker, which gets you the Batman Who Laughs, who I think is a terrible character, and the whole idea of him stupid and doesn't work for me. But the thing that makes the Grim Knight unique is it's not Batman mixed with anybody. It's Batman, you know, as Snyder said, mixed with the Punisher, but obviously the Punisher is not even a DC character. and he doesn't actually merge. Like if you've read any of those one shots from Dark Knight's Metal, you see how Batman went up against, you know, another one of these heroes, and they eventually like merged powers or whatever happened in the dark multiverse. But this is different. This is Batman. This is Bruce Wayne just taking a different path and ending up being this gun loving, weapon loving, you know, extremist basically. And so in the story, he's actually sort of the Batman Who Laughs, because this one shot does tie into the Batman Who Laughs mini, which I think was a 6-issue that basically bridges what the Batman Who Laughs is doing between the time of Metal and his first early appearances in Scott Snyder's Justice League before Year of the Villain, where he starts preparing the way for Perpetua. And so that Batman Who Laughs miniseries is sort of fits in there. And the Grim Knight is sort of the Batman Who Laughs sort of right-hand man. So in here, he's captured Jim Gordon and he's marching him off. And the Batman Who Laughs actually calls him and says, you shouldn't be playing with your food, because he has other plans for Jim Gordon. He's supposed to basically just be bringing Jim Gordon to the Batman Who Laughs once he captures him. But instead, he takes him to Crime Alley. And then we sort of learn, well, first we get a flashback and we learn the origin, like I said, of that world's, that dark multiverse version of Bruce Wayne picking up the gun and shooting Joe Chill. And then once the Grim Knight gets Jim Gordon under the streets of Crime Alley, where he was of this world, but you know, it's an analog for the Crime Alley of his own world, where he basically became who he was. Like I said, we get sort of the origin of it, and it's sort of cool. You know, it's that classic scene where he's sitting in his father's study and he thinks about how, you know, he needs to strike fear in the hearts of evil. How can he do that? And the bat comes flying through the window and he decides to start dressing as a bat. So in this one, it says, you know, he needed a way to kill evil, and he's sitting in the chair, and at his feet are all these guns and explosives and knives and just all these weapons. And the bat comes flying in and he shoots it and says, oh, I'll become a bat. But, you know, obviously a different sort of bat. And so he's relaying all this information to the Jim Gordon of our world. And our Jim Gordon is telling him, like, why? Like, what? The Joker screwed up the Batman who laughs. Like, I get that. Who was it for you? Two-Face, the Court of Owls? You know, maybe you felt like you needed to go full military, is how Jim Gordon describes it, to fight somebody like Bane. But what we're being told in the background is that because of the war that the Grim Knight waged, because we get a scene, that famous scene from Frank Miller's Year One, where he, you know, steps into that dining room where all the fat cats of Gotham City are eating and basically warns them, hey, you know, your time feeding on Gotham is over. In this case, the Grim Knight, he doesn't tell them that their time is over. Watch out for me. He says, your feast is over. And from this moment on, no one's safe. And he burns all those people alive. Like he just starts stomping out crime left and right. So we're told that, you know, once he killed all the men and women in that room, and it basically started a chain reaction that, you know, caused chaos in the city. And from that chaos, the Grim Knight was able to establish order. So he took down Falcone, took down Zuko, and there was never a real rise in the sort of colorful villains, if you will, the Batman rogues gallery. That never happened in the world of the Grim Knight. He even says there was never a murderous clown, though I remember I did kill a man in a red hood at Ace Chemical. So, you know, because there wasn't that sort of revolving door, there wasn't any sort of, you know, super villains or Batman villains that the Grim Knight had to go up against. So he sort of ruled Gotham with an iron fist, using a bunch of Wayne technology to do it. And his biggest enemy was actually the Gotham City Police Department and Jim Gordon in general. And that's the majority of this issue here, tells how Jim Gordon, you know, discovers who he is, discovers that he's Bruce Wayne, and he's eventually able to capture Bruce Wayne, you know, even though he tries to deny that he had anything to do with it. And the first time he tries to go after Batman, he's foiled by the fact that a bunch of the police officers that are there to take Batman down are wearing Wayne Tech equipment. And so Batman's able to overcome that because obviously he has, you know, built-in safeguards. So then when Gordon figures out, hey, Batman's Bruce Wayne, and he makes sure that there's no Wayne Tech equipment there, and he does eventually take him out. We're not told how he goes from being arrested in his world to being in our world. Obviously, the Batman Who Laughs freed him. And that we might even been told that in the regular Batman Who Laughs series. I honestly don't remember. But he's about to kill the Jim Gordon of this world because the Batman Who Laughs, even though he wants Jim Gordon for his plans, the Grim Knight doesn't think that this guy's capable of it. He even says, because the Batman Who Laughs does show up and he stops the Grim Knight from killing Jim Gordon. And he tells the Grim Knight, hey, this isn't the way, this isn't what we agreed on. And the Grim Knight says, this is not the same guy, he, you know, with what we know Jim Gordon's capable of. And, you know, the Batman Who Laughs reminds Grim Knight, yeah, well, that's right. He is a different Gordon. So, you know, he is the boss. The Batman Who Laughs is in charge. And he does save Jim Gordon. And Jim Gordon's kind of surprised. He's like, wow, you of all people, I would have thought that you would have wanted the Grim Knight to have his revenge. And the Batman Who Laughs starts chuckling and says, is that what you think this is, revenge? Oh, man, you're in for a real treat because this isn't about revenge. He was going to show you mercy by killing you because what I have in store for you is far worse than death. And then we're told that the story will continue in the Batman Who Laughs number 4. So it's an okay story. The Eduardo Risso art, I mean, he's definitely shown his skills here because he draws it in two different styles. When we get the flashback, it looks much different than the story that's told in our world. But I'm not a big fan of Eduardo Risso. I don't think the art works for me that well in either situation. So, I mean, it's okay. It tells the story. It does its job, but it's not anything. Like, I definitely wouldn't and don't go out of my way to purchase things that Eduardo Risso draws. I'm just not a fan. His stuff just doesn't do it for me. The most interesting part is thinking about how different the Grim Knight is from all those other versions of the Dark Knight Batman that we talked about, because they are hybrids. And this is Bruce Wayne on his own, not mixed with anybody, who just chose a different path. And you can start thinking about how realistic that is, you know, if it really would have gone that way. And I'm sure there's a certain subsection, probably mostly Zack Snyder fans, that are also Batman fans that think this is like the greatest thing since sliced bread. You know, why wouldn't Batman kill, heroes kill, blah, blah, blah. But for me, it's really disturbing to see a Bruce Wayne make that decision as a child to pick up a gun and kill Joe Chill. And I get it. He just killed your parents. So I understand. But it's still, there's something inherently tragic about that, because this is Batman, who could have been one of the greatest heroes, and he ends up being really a pretty big villain. So it's an interesting story, gives a lot of food for thought. He's an interesting character, but I don't know, in a way, just like I feel that the Batman Who Laughs is a worse character, because I don't even think he's interesting, because you're talking about Batman and Joker, and we all know how I feel about the Joker. So I think Grim Knight inherently has a little more value than the Batman Who Laughs, who I think is a garbage character. But either way, I think both of them, in their own way, just by existing, they sort of, in my mind, lessen Batman as a character. They sort of, just based on the fact that they exist, and it's like, you're talking about an evil Bruce Wayne, it sort of contaminates the idea of who Bruce is. And I get it, like, right, you're talking about what is the one thing about Bruce that exists throughout all these different versions? What's that obsessiveness? It's that single-mindedness. It's that force of will, that willpower that he has. So whatever he's going to set himself on, he's going to achieve, you know, never gives up, just relentless. And so if it's, if it's turned or contaminated or takes a different path at all, it can lead you astray. But again, I think it just lessens who Bruce is as a character, because you're basically saying that a split second decision could change who the core of Bruce Wayne is. You know, I'd like to think that Bruce Wayne, you know, despite his methods sometimes, like deep down at his very core, is a very moral person. He's a hero. He will do the right thing, regardless of whether he's infected with Joker venom, or regardless of whether he sees his parents, you know, killed in front of him and has a chance to pick up a gun and kill the guy that kills him. I don't know. I just think he would choose a different path. I would like to think that. To me, that's what a hero is, not somebody who picks up a gun and basically sinks to the same level as Joe Chill. So I don't know. It's an interesting thought. It's a book that does provoke thought about who Bruce Wayne is. And so I think it has value that way. And it's certainly written well. I think the dialogue works. But again, it ties in so closely to Batman Who Laughs, who I can't stand. So I don't know. I don't know where I come out. I don't think I recommend this ultimately. I mean, because I've told you everything you need to know in order to think about whether you think a Batman Punisher hybrid is a good idea or not. So you don't need to actually go and read this. But if you're a fan of the Batman Who Laughs and that sort of thing, and you think he's cool, then you'll probably dig this. Had you read this before, Jay?
Yeah, I kind of, when I first read it, I thought, okay, I'll just go in here to see what it's about. But yeah, it was pretty dark, and being a, you know, diehard Batman fan, I didn't like it, because you're right, that's not the Batman you come to love over so many years. You know, I was like, oh man, this is dark. And I kind of saw it more as a what if, like, you know, Marvel was like, what if he made it the different choice, and this is what you're going to get. But I mean, he just went totally dark. And in the book, though, he uses his Wayne tech to like stop crime ahead of time, if I remember correctly. So it's like, I don't think Bruce would ever do that either.
Yeah. He, like, on that night where Gordon basically what he does is he builds the bat signal for the first time. He turns it on to summon the Grim Knight to the rooftop of the police station. And it's not just a light. He said it's also a magnet. He turns it on. It's this powerful magnet. And so obviously, being the weapon lover that the Grim Knight is, he's immediately like pulled over to the spotlight, and he's like stuck on there. And Gordon tells him, yeah, we caught you. And he's got this cadre of, you know, very well equipped special SWAT police officers there to take Batman in. And they're all wearing like Wayne Tech body armor and have all kinds of Wayne Tech weapons. Meanwhile, around the city, Jim Gordon saying, yeah, around the city, we also have, we found a bunch of your stashes of weapons that you have left throughout the city. And we're taking those out too. But really, Batman was one step ahead all along, just like Batman usually is. And he knew Gordon was going to do this. And so then he basically sets off a detonation. He explodes all those caches of weapons and kills a bunch of police officers who were told were corrupt police officers anyway. This is in Batman's mind, in the Grim Knight's mind, he's killing a bunch of criminals. They're corrupt cops that Gordon had bribed to go and take these caches of weapons out. Meanwhile, the SWAT guys, who also are corrupt, apparently all their body armor explodes. So they're all taken out. And the only one left is Jim Gordon. And as Batman's beating up Jim Gordon, Batman also tells him, the Grim Knight also tells him, yeah. And you know, those two like Gotham City Police Department blimps that you have floating above the city. Well, they're going to, one of them is going to crash into Blackgate Prison and explode. And the other one's going to crash into Arkham Asylum and explode. And we'll kill a bunch of criminals that way. So yeah, you're right. Like the Grim Knight, like I said, he's weaponized all of Gotham. We even see Alfred make a brief appearance to basically tell Grim Knight, hey, this is not what your parents would want. Your parents would be ashamed of you. I'm leaving. And that's actually how Jim Gordon eventually catches the Grim Knight. Basically Alfred betrays Bruce Wayne, and that's how he's captured. So yeah, don't know how his world was eventually destroyed. Don't know how, and it might've been, again, I'm thinking I remember it being in the Batman Who Laughs series, but it's been so long since I read that, I don't remember. But obviously he's betrayed it all now and come to our world, and he's working for the Batman Who Laughs. And and wants his revenge on Jim Gordon. So, yeah, I mean, it's an okay story, but the problem I have with it, I think it's the same problem you have. It just doesn't feel like Batman at all. Yeah, no. It's a what if, but it's not a what if. It's not an idea that I really want to think about too much.
Yeah, because it's like, okay, he can do that because he's got the brains, he's got the money, he's got the technology, but it's like, yeah, hopefully he never does it.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like thinking about, okay, well, what if Spider-Man was a villain? Like, I don't see the worth in that. Like, it's so not who he is.
No.
And you can make the argument for the other Dark Knights that Batman was corrupted in the combining of it, right? Like, as much as I hate the Batman who laughs and the whole idea of him, you can see why he's a villain, because the Joker venom corrupted Bruce Wayne and made him into a crazy psychopath like the Joker. So you can understand why he's bad. There's an underlying reason. Here, the only reason the Grim Knight is bad is because in that moment, Joe Chill dropped his gun and Bruce Wayne picked it up and killed Joe Chill. And so he's like, oh, now I love guns, and a love of guns brought this. It kind of doesn't make sense when you think about it. So you're telling me Bruce Wayne was never a hero. The only reason he was a hero is because he didn't kill Joe Chill and went and trained and hated guns. Like, it just, I don't know.
Yeah, it was a little out there. Like I said, it's, if you read it, yeah, you might like the I guess the character, the concept of it all, but I got it because I wanted to kind of see where they were going with it. And I was like, eh, okay, I just kind of put it away. Never read it again. Cause sometimes I'll read books twice, and that was one of the ones I didn't want to read again. I was like, I'm done with that.
Yeah. And I get it. Like, it's the dark multiverse, and it's supposed to be a twisted, dark reflection of our world. And I guess in that way it definitely works, but yeah, I agree with you. It's not something I wanted to read again. So anyway, let's move on to Hawkman number 10. This one's written by Robert Venditti. Pencils are by Brian Hitch. Inks are by Andrew Curry and Brian Hitch. Colors by Jeremiah Skipper. Letters by Richard Starkings. So this is part 3 of Cataclysm. And, you know, a bigger part of the overall story that Robert Venditti is telling with Hawkman, which is a great story we've talked about on the podcast before. Venditti found a way to make that crazy convoluted history and continuity of Hawkman makes sense. So if you weren't following along, you didn't read any of it, and you plan on it, we're going to spoil here. So you may want to, that's why I've saved this one for last. So if you're planning on reading at some point and you don't want it spoiled, here's your warning. Otherwise, I'm going to talk about what Venditti has done to sort of fix Hawkman's continuity. So there's this concept of these death bringers. And what we learn is that these death bringers worship this being called the Lord Beyond the Void. And at the early, early, early beginning of time, Carter Hall was actually Katar, and he was the leader of the army of death bringers. And he would travel throughout the solar system and the galaxy, and he would capture humans, and he would take them to the void where the Lord Beyond the Void lived and dwelt, and he would like push them in. And supposedly, by sacrificing these humanoid beings, most of them were like human races, human, whether from Earth or from Thanagar or Ran or wherever. And once they reached a certain quota of beings, thousands and thousands, if not millions, of human sacrifices to this Lord Beyond the Void, the Lord was supposed to be able to finally exit the void and come into our reality or our world or what have you. So Hawkman turns out to be, in his very first incarnation, was a bad guy. But in his heart, apparently he was a good guy. And after who knows how many, doesn't say how many years, he sort of turns on the other death bringers, and he seals up the void. And he betrays his friend, who was, you know, very bloodthirsty and sort of his right-hand man. His name was Idam, and throws him in the void as well. And then he's sort of killed in the battle, or supposedly killed. But then there's some being or some benevolent force that gives Katar a choice, like, okay, you're not dead. You're in the unlife. You're in the kind of the between place. And, you know, you have a choice to go and suffer for all eternity for all these people you've killed, or we can, you can choose to be reincarnated over and over and over throughout time and space. So you live a life on Krypton and then you die and you go and you live a life on Thanagar and then you die and you go and live a life on Earth and then you die. And they're not always necessarily linear in terms of time. Like you're reincarnating, you know, you could die in like 1980 on Earth. And then when you're reborn on Thanagar in what would be the Earth time of the 1600s. Like, so you're jumping around through time and you're jumping around in space. So that's how Venditti is explaining this. And so that's the offer that was given to Qatar. You can spend, you know, however long it takes making up for all the people that you've, whose deaths you've contributed to. And once you've balanced the scales, once you've saved as many people as you sacrificed, then you'll be able to die a normal death and have peace. You know, you won't go and suffer for all eternity. So, you know, Qatar being, you know, a relatively noble being, despite his being a leader of the Deathbringers, that's what he agrees to. And so that kind of explains why Hawkman has been reincarnated and he can't die like over and over. But the thing is, modern day Hawkman has forgotten a lot of this stuff. He doesn't know. And he's starting to feel, for whatever reason, the lack of that. Like he's getting little hints of it. He's dreaming about the Deathbringers, dreaming about them perhaps returning. And so he actually goes on a quest to sort of discover. He's like, man, I know so much about the history of Earth and the history of Ran and the history of Thanagar, but it's my own history that I don't know. And that's what he kind of goes in search of. And he discovers all of this stuff that I just explained in the first 9 issues. He travels around, he meets past selves and sort of puts this all together, learns about the Deathbringers and everything. And in issue 9, the Deathbringers do return. They do show up on Earth and they're really powerful. And their goal is to destroy all the planets that the Great Betrayer, that's what they call Carter Hall or Hawkman. They consider him to be the Great Betrayer because he betrayed the Lord Beyond the Void right at the moment the Lord Beyond the Void was going to be reincarnated or come, be able to come into our world. He was so close. He only needed a few more human sacrifices. And so, you know, the rest of the Deathbringers who worship this god are, they call Hawkman the Great Betrayer for, you know, snatching victory away from them at the last instant. So they're Carter Hall. Hawkman is currently here on Earth. So they are here on Earth to destroy all of Earth, kill all the humans on Earth to get revenge on Carter Hall for them betraying him. So most of the issue is a big fight between Carter Hall and IDAM. And then the other thing is there's the Deathbringers. They also have these giant robotic looking ships that are sort of humanoid looking, but within those ships house the actual Deathbringers, which are a bunch of winged warriors, which, you know, suits the story you're telling. If you're talking about Hawkman, he can fly and he's a great fighter, which, you know, we've had Robert Venditti on the show several times to talk about this, how Hawkman has lived so long, he literally would be the best like fighter in the DC universe because he's lived the, you know, just like Wolverine has lived so long and knows every dirty trick in the book, sort of the same thing with Hawkman. Plus he'd be the best flyer, you know, in terms of maneuverability and air combat and all that stuff, again, because he's done it for so long. So he goes and he takes on these winged Deathbringers and he does a pretty good job of taking quite a few of them out, but he is vastly outnumbered. I mean, there's hundreds, if not thousands of these Deathbringers, you know, a whole army of them. And there's just one Carter Hall. So eventually he's overpowered by just the sheer number of them as he's fighting in the skies above London. And eventually he finds himself sort of overmatched and outgunned. And he's knocked down on the top of a building where IDAM, who he had knocked out earlier, has sort of come to and is there sort of mocking him, saying, you know, you failed and the earth is going to fall and it's your fault. And next comes Thanagar and then Ran and then Andrino and Starhaven and Tebris. And I won't stop. The blood of 1,000 worlds is all going to be on your hands, because you alone can never stop us. And Carter Hall saying, yeah, I see it. You know, I spent this life and so many others digging through history, looking for explanations. And recently I've been calling backward to my past. And I thought today during this fight that my past was trying to call me back to it. But what I realized is it was calling me to do something else. And I have you to thank for that. And Idam's like, wait, what do you mean, me? He's like, yeah, I didn't realize it till this moment when you're standing over me with the scars of the wounds that I gave you all those years ago at the beginning of this, when I, you know, kept the Lord from beyond the void from manifesting. And Idam's like, what are you talking about? And we see Carter Hall sort of concentrate, and he says, you're the final clue, right? Like, I was recently told that I've been skipping across the ocean of time, reconnecting with my past self. And what I realized is oceans have shores, and I'm the shore of my present, and you're the shore on the other side. That's my past. And in between that, in that vast ocean between these two shores, is every life that I've lived, every, you know, reincarnation, every winged warrior I ever was. And one of my past selves supposedly had a weapon that he was trying to build to beat you, but he wasn't able to complete it before he died. And he told me I would have to be the weapon. And he's right, but I don't have to be the weapon. I have to be the army. And so he concentrates, and it seems to be very painful, according to the scream and the pain depicted on his face by Brian Hitch. But what Hawkman is able to do is, between those two shores, that ocean of time that he's been reincarnated throughout, he's able to connect with all those parts of his consciousness, and all those Hawkmen, if you will, basically appear. And so now he has an army of his own. And Idam's like, it can't be. You have a new army and they're all you? And he's like, how can this be? And Hawkman says, I'm using history to save the future, my history. And Idam's like, well, fine. You want it to be a blood soaked end. It'll be army against army. And if it's a war you want, it's a war you'll have. And he's stabbing towards Hawkman with a spear as he says that. So I guess we'll see when the next issue starts, issue 11, just how damaged Hawkman is. Cause we see a schnick and from Hawkman. And we're told that the next issue is Blood Red Skies. So we're definitely going to have a big battle. It's going to be the Deathbringers against literally an army of Carter Halls from across time and space, from all different walks of life. So pretty cool idea, pretty cool concept. And, you know, I've talked about it a lot, how great this Hawkman series is. I never really thought that anybody would be able to make sense out of Hawkman's continuity, but Robert Venditti, to his credit, found a way to make it work. So, and I know you were even saying something similar, Jay, when we talked about covering this issue.
Yeah. Well, I like all the characters, but when growing up, I would read Hawkman, I was always confused about where he came from, his backstory. It's like, it doesn't make sense, because there's just too many timelines. And then when you gave me this book, and then you gave me the other books, I'm like, oh, Venditti did a beautiful job. Now it makes more sense. He put it together, and just that one scene in the, I guess it was the double page, where it shows all the Hawkmen coming through. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah. Do you have any favorites on that double page spread? That
I don't know. I guess it's like a giant size version of him. There's like one that's kind of like in the middle. He's kind of like a big one. Was he a giant at one time or something, or what's the deal there?
I don't know. I mean, we weren't told that.
There's like a little bitty guy flying by the big guy. So I'm thinking, well, maybe he was just like a giant man at one time. I'm not too sure.
I mean, very well may have been. But I like the one that's on the right side that kind of has the Rocketeer helmet on.
Oh, yeah. It's the futuristic one.
Yeah. Just because that Rocketeer helmet, it looks so, I mean, it's a great job by Venditti. He gives us a bunch of different designs. And we'll see more. We'll get to see some of these guys up close in the next issue.
Cool.
But yeah, it's, again, it just goes to show that anything's possible. I mean, I never would have thought there would be a way to make Hawkman's continuity all make sense. And then, you know, when we had Rob on the first time, he's like, don't worry, I have a plan. You'll see. And then, you know, when we find out, I think it's issue 5, sort of what's happening. And it's such a simple idea that he comes up with, that he's, you know, reincarnating across time and space, and he bounces, you know, so that allows him to bounce around to different planets, you know, because the whole thing was, well, is he from Thanagar? Is he an ancient archaeologist from Earth? And then how does it all make sense? Because sometimes it doesn't go linear, like, oh, well, he was on Earth at this time, but then he was on Thanagar, but then he was back on Earth, and it doesn't, you know, it doesn't make sense. But then when you hear about, well, he could, anytime he dies, he can travel through time and through space and appear anywhere. It starts making perfect sense. So you think about it, it's sort of like Quantum Leap, like the Scott Bakula TV show in a way.
Oh, yeah. I just glad he cleaned it up, though. It was just amazing. Yeah. Now I feel kind of bad. It's like, oh, I should have collected it when it first came out. But, you know, live and learn, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think Rob really wanted it to go 50 issues. Because we've never had a Hawkman series go that far. But yeah, ultimately it did eventually get canceled. But yeah, it's a great series. I highly recommend it. There's a lot of action. Now, I'm not normally a big Brian Hitch fan. I don't really care for, especially his faces. But his line work is something that I'm not a big fan of either. But there's no denying the guy's a great storyteller. He lays out things and action within panels really good. He's a great character designer. So this made me more of a Hitch fan than I've ever been before. But the art for me isn't the end all be all. Now it's got great color work throughout the series. So I definitely give props for that. And so, I don't know, I'm kind of, I go back and forth on the art. Sometimes I get really sucked in and I don't notice. And then other times there'll just be a panel or a face or something that just doesn't do it for me. And again, it's an aesthetic thing. It's just a taste thing. Cause I know a lot of people really like Brian Hitch, and he's one of the first artists that really did what they, I guess now is called like the cinematic or widescreen style, where you get everything, you know, you're pulling the camera back, you're zooming out, and you're getting more of a landscape thing. Now it's sort of overdone, I feel like, a little bit. But when you're talking about telling a story as epic as what Venditti is doing here, and, you know, obviously you're going to need to have the camera pretty far back to be able to see, you know, 1,000 Hawkmen flying in the sky. So again, I think Hitch is a great choice for that. It's just a matter of taste in the style, but overall, this is a really great book, really great series. I highly recommend it. You can pick it. It's all out in trade now. You can pick it up in trade, or you can find the issues are not too terribly, expensive. So, anything else you want to say about any of the books that we covered, Jay?
No, like I say, you kind of hooked me in with the Hawkman. I wasn't really expecting what I read, but it was pretty good. It's really good. For me, if the story's good, the artwork's meh, I'll just still read the story. I just love the story. The story sucks me in. I'm just going to go for it.
Yeah, I agree. So, we'll be covering future issues of Hawkman in some upcoming spotlights as well. So, all right. Well, I guess that's going to do it for this episode, everybody. I want to thank you for joining us as always, and we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.